For it was in the temple of this god of the sea that the ancient tablets were preserved, giving the will of the gods for mankind. If people migrating in various directions and at various times had traveled in different directions from their motherland and had sought finally to establish their cultures again, they would not have the fantastic wealth or the tremendous number of skilled laborers or probably the wonderful basic materials with which to work. Remember, these people were scattered by a great catastrophe. Most of them escaped only with their lives. They found themselves in primitive worlds. They found themselves far from the familiar and the known. But at the same time, they found themselves likewise with a great gratitude in their hearts. Regardless of the tragedy and horror that had come, the great darkness that had swallowed up their city with fire and water, they had been spared, and it became essential for them to restore their religion, to reestablish their faith wherever they were. Even as the children of Israel, moving in the wilderness for 40 years, found it necessary to the preservation of their faith that they create a tabernacle which was portable, which could be disassembled and reassembled as need arose. So these other people wandering about undoubtedly created various types of structures. They created according to the available materials. Where they remained long and established powerful centers, they built much more massively and much more permanently. And where their sojourn was brief, they naturally left less permanent and less solid remains. But around the world and in the passing of time and their strange wanderings, these people left culture after culture behind them. We do not know why. Perhaps they were driven out by the rise of other peoples around them, or as some have suspected, they perished or were forced to leave because of the impoverishment of soil and some basic lack of knowledge of hygiene or sanitation. Perhaps they were unable to survive in climates and conditions distant from their own. Perhaps they destroyed their food supplies and were unable to replenish them. For in Central America, certainly, one of the great themes in the whole area was the impoverishment of soil and the necessity for the annual burning of the land in order to provide food. Perhaps some of these structures also were placed in inhospitable climates where it was not possible for the people to live and remain healthy, as in the morasses of Palenque in the Mexican area. In any event, these buildings were progressively left. Perhaps in some cases these people were overrun by other tribes who led them into captivity. And again, it is possible that race suicide destroyed some of them. But all around are the bones of these ancient structures. Another group of thinkers have come to a somewhat different conclusion, namely that even perhaps before the destruction of Atlantis, during its great period of colonization, temples and centers could have been established in comparatively distant areas. For instance, we observe the spread of religion in our world as it is today. We note the wonderful buildings in France and in Germany and in Italy. We observe also that fine religious structures have sprung up on our hemisphere. And the cathedrals of Europe are not to be regarded as so much better than the great cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, which is being built on precisely the same principles, with a tremendous time-labor equivalence of those of the cathedrals of the ancient world. It's quite possible that these buildings existed before the destruction of Atlantis, at least some of them, where the more highly advanced colonization developments had brought perhaps Atlantean families and communities into permanent residence in distant places. So that the Atlanteans had their colonies, as we have, and that their own people were served by priesthoods and temples created for the purpose, and also for the worship of converted natives of the same general regions. If this great colonizing plan collapsed due to the destruction of its central island, then it is quite possible that the peoples gradually drifted away from the knowledge of the arts and sciences which were originally taught. Budge brings up the Osiris legend in Egypt of the destruction of the good god by Typhon, who is the symbol of storms and violence, and considers the possibility of an Osirian era, an era of wisdom and light, destroyed by flames, fire, war, pestilence, and death. The same thought occurs in Central America, where the god Quetzalcoatl is finally destroyed by a fire spirit, who corresponds very closely to the Typhon or Seth monster of the Egyptians. If then it is conceivable that the Atlantic culture represented the establishment of powerful institutions, it is also quite understandable why the legends continue to remain that at one time man possessed divine knowledge, that he possessed the secret of all things, that he possessed the word of power. In Egypt, he possessed the mysterious power represented by the unsated cross, or the Crux and Sata, the key to the mystery of eternal life, the key to the true meaning of God and to the sacred name, symbolism which we find in Egypt, where the goddess Isis throws Ra, the sun god, under a spell and finally forces him to reveal his true name, which is the word of power. In the Egyptian legend, the death of Osiris resulted in the loss of the word of life. The death of Osiris could be very symbolical. It could represent, for one thing, the loss of the descent of the great hierarchical priestly orders. With the destruction of Atlantis, it was no longer possible for disciples and students to reach this great center of learning and be duly invested with the secrets of divine magic. Therefore, by degrees, these temples scattered about the world, for loss of the great central spiritual authority, fell into decline and to decay. They were served for a time by priests who used substitute rituals, who found various ways to perpetuate as best they could the old rites. But with no longer the civilizing influences, no longer contact, with great problems arising and the decadence of their own local groups, these buildings fell into decline and were gradually forgotten. There is also, of course, the very definite possibility that these great temples, variously located, were never actually cities, that they were universities or schools like the great Nalanda in India, and that there were no communities around them, and that they were always in the midst of jungles, as in the rites of Xibalba among the Quiches of Central America, and that pilgrims and truth seekers journeyed into these inaccessible areas to receive instructions from venerable orders of priests who never mingled with mankind. If these venerable orders gradually died out, the buildings remained in the jungle, which gradually also encroached upon them until they disappeared from the sight of medieval or even ancient men. All of this complex of buildings, variously but magnificently located in the most important culture zones of the earth, apparently designed with the skill of advanced geometry and with a wonderful knowledge of building materials. Buildings in which great structures were held together solely by the lacing of their own carvings, or as in the case of the Great Pyramid, where the stones were fitted together with cement no thicker than writing paper. And this cement so strong that it is easier to break a stone than it is to divide it from another. We do not know all of the answers, but we begin to suspect that there are answers that are different from what we have believed. We know that the builders of these monuments were great experts in architecture and art, in mathematics and in astronomy. We know that they worshipped astronomical symbols, and that among their buildings many were actually dedicated as observatories. We know that these people are not the ones whom we find scattered in little thatched villages around these monuments. The modern peoples claim descent from these older ones, but they claim a descent of gradual forgetfulness. They do not remember their forebears. Many of them do not even speak the ancient languages of their gods. They are now merely remnants, looking as astonished as the average tourist upon the shrines and temples of the past. While I was at Uxmal in Yucatan, one day a whole group of Mayas, we call them 100% Mayas, they really were, came in a kind of a bus from one of the neighboring towns. They were tourists visiting their own ruins. None of them had ever seen them before. And they were as amazed and dumbfounded as any absolute stranger. They did not have a memory of who built these structures. But among the old men, among the ancient ones, there were legends. Always there are legends. And these legends had to do with times long gone by when a race of gods walked the earth. Same legends in Africa. Same legends among the heroic peoples of the Polynesian Islands. Here in Samoa, in the Hebrides, and in all through this area, children initiated into the rituals of their tribes watch the building of the sacred mountain and learn again that it is from this ancient mountain that the laws of their people once came, as these laws thundered from the crest of the blazing volcanic peak of Sinai. All these legends, and there seems to be some meaning for them that they should be so universally distributed. Though it is interesting also to trace what you might call this distribution story in areas very far removed from the Atlantic Ocean. We could imagine that any group of people inhabiting the Atlantic shore, either on the eastern or western side, would be somewhat acquainted with these stories, especially if they related back to the old legends of their people. But why should the people of Tahiti, or one of these islands in the extreme opposite side of the world, natives of Madagascar, or why should the primitive peoples of the Philippine Islands have similar stories? Yet it is true that the primitive records of the natives, the old forgotten natives, like the Batus of Sumatra, the very old ones, the Bushmen of Australia, these people all record that long ago, once upon a time, there was a great deluge. And this deluge destroyed the great lands and changed continents into oceans. And at that time, great cultures, great races of giants, races of heroic beings, even the gods and demigods themselves, vanished away in a Ragnarok of fire and destruction. How did these people find out about it? What is the reason for their memory? Why is the story of the deluge still carefully traced upon the totem poles of our Alaskan and Canadian Indians? Yet they have their deluge myth, just as surely as did the people of Mesopotamia. There has to be another and a little more light cast upon this situation. Assuming for a moment now what we must assume, from actual available record, there should have been, and well was, a long continental shelf extending out from India and involving part of Australia, a tremendous area, on which most of what we call the Polynesian and Melanesian Islands, or Melanesian Islands, are a part. that just as surely as we had a continental shelf in the Atlantic, we had a vast shelf in the Indian Ocean, a shelf of land area perhaps as large as that we associate with Atlantis. It is difficult to imagine what may have happened. It is possible that at a very remote time, the sinking of this Lemurian shelf in the Asiatic side, the Gondwana land of ancient legend and lore, resulted in the emergence of Atlantis. Or it is possible that the great cataclysm which destroyed Atlantis also shook down this Pacific shelf, causing in that way what might well have passed to be something more important than we think of in connection with Atlantis. If the Atlantic catastrophe was not merely located in the Atlantic basin, but represented some tremendous cataclysm that involved both the eastern and western hemispheres, and the possibility that these disorders and these changes affected tides and water distributions, causing perhaps the entire Atlantic, Pacific, Indian Ocean group to be agitated, disturbed, then perhaps we could understand why the peoples of the eastern hemisphere could have and would have a similar story. Something of this kind had to have happened to explain the Chinese knowledge and the belief, of course, that they had that vast areas like the Gobi Desert or the great Shamo sand ocean was, of course, at one time underwater. All of this points out not simply a local catastrophe, but perhaps a much larger one. One of greater magnitude, greater significance, in which two or more poles of a great disaster struck nearly at the same time, or close enough for their historical backgrounds to be interwoven. It seems, therefore, reasonably certain that the African continent that we know today was particularly East Africa, toward the Asiatic side, perhaps originally connected with the Lemurian or Gondwana land distribution. Whereas West Africa, as we know it today, might well have been contiguous to and highly influenced by the Atlantean culture and its disaster. This would support the belief of Frobenius that two distinct cultures, one much older than the other, flourished together on this continent. We have no evidence at this time as to the cultural level of the ancient Lemurian group. What we seemingly find is that they did not attain to any pronounced skill or ability in the preparation or preservation of records. They did not appear to have built extensively or to have created any monumental palaces or temples or to have highly perfected any permanent art. This would correspond to their psychology today because these people do not have a memory of greatness. On the other hand, this second group, the Atlantean group, certainly possessed this memory of greatness and also prove in their daily living now that they have an exceptional skill in a great many forms of arts and crafts. If then we can assume that the Atlantean group may have been the earliest to have left strongly and clearly marked culture, we may then assume that the Lemurian culture, whatever it was of such an impermanent nature that it did not actually survive. There is the possibility that these people did have a knowledge of monolithic stones and the simple methods of moving them as preserved today in the remnants of Easter Island. Easter Island is regarded as a Lemurian remnant. Actually, however, we have no proof of this. We might just as well assume that these statues were the result of an overlay of Atlantean culture later, because they do show some primitive knowledge of engineering, which up to now we have not been able to associate with Lemuria, but which we know flourished in Atlantis. Now let's think for just a few moments about the idea of the Atlantean mountain in its relationship to group pyramid construction throughout the world. The pyramid, of course, as we know, passes through innumerable variations and refinements. At its beginning, there seems to be the tendency to regard it as a copy of something. There is no doubt that the pyramid builders throughout the world were building from an archetype, either in their memories or in their records. They were copying something. A pyramid such as that at Cheops does not accumulate, nor does the great pyramid structure which has been recently found in China indicate that these people were merely massing things together. This building program was purposed. And the pyramid, wherever it stands, is a symbol, as it was in Egypt, of the World Mountain. And the World Mountain, almost certainly, was symbolic of the first enduring religious structure that man knew, and that was the great university system of Atlantis. Prior to that time, we have no evidence of anything that could have been copied. But this could have been copied. Another point that is interesting is that where these pyramids appear, in different parts of the world, their architecture is startlingly similar. There are certain modifications, and with the passing of time, the symbolic pyramid idea began to disappear under elaborate ornamentation, which itself is a sign of decadence. However, the buildings basically are great mathematical solids. They are built approximately in the same theme wherever they are located. And with the exception of local embellishments belonging to later cultures, they are very simple, monumental masses of structure, essentially resembling what we call the Pyramid of Egypt. These pyramids, therefore, seemingly all come from one purpose and design. Now, the idea that we have that the pyramids were the tombs of Egyptian pharaohs is a matter of moot question even now. The Great Pyramid, certainly the oldest, and the archetype for most of the others in Egypt, was most unsuitable to be a royal crypt. It presented serious obstacles for the functional uses we assume inspired it. For example, we can have no understanding as to why ventilating shafts should be provided through 200 feet of masonry to give air circulation to a tomb. It was not done in the case of ordinary tombs. If it had been part of the religion of the Egyptians that their deceased must be given air ventilation, it might be different, but there is no indication that such is the case. Also, if such is the case, why were these air shafts blocked at their inner ends with slabs of stone so that they serve no function whatever? Yet these stone slabs are contemporary with the original building. We have no understanding of such procedure. The sarcophagus in the king's chamber is simply not adequate to receive a human body. It is too small for the ceremonial wrappings used in connection with the Egyptian dead. It seems much more like a font than it does like a sarcophagus. Even a comparatively unimportant second or third grade prince would have had a sarcophagus three times the size of the one in the Great Pyramid. And yet this was supposedly for the King of Kings, the ruler of them all. Even without additional mummy wrappings or without additional means of the preserving of the body, it would have been difficult to simply get the corpse into the sarcophagus. Something else was evidently intended, and the tomb idea was imposed upon it later. What the building was originally intended for must cause considerable thought, unless we again assume that it was copied from one of the sacred structures of the ancient Atlantean Empire, that it had a meaning deep and mysterious for these people, a meaning which perhaps rooted in their religion, in their spiritual conviction, and was used in connection with the initiatory rites by means of which their knowledge was transmitted. This is quite conceivable also in the fact that there is a well-established report that Plato was initiated in the Great Pyramid. Yet at the time of Plato, there was no visible entrance. Therefore, such entrance had to have been through some subterranean connection between the pyramid and other structures. Rumors of such a connection have long endured, but the connection has not yet been clearly identified. But this does not mean that it did not exist. Harmachis, the Great Sphinx, is another riddle that goes back to an old way of life. The composite Sphinx monster perhaps is again part of the Atlantean story, having to do with their religious system and rites. Irish people claim that the first teachers of their race came not from the East, from Europe, but from the West, and that ancient robed priests came out of the ocean on the west coast of Ireland, and that these were the ones who instructed them. The Irish have a considerable folklore dealing with Atlantis. There is also a great deal of lore relating to this in the Spanish area and in Portugal. And of course, what is left of North Africa bears testimony to the same basic accounts. Thus we have the indication of a stratification of cultures, which becomes a strong defending point in support of our Atlantis hypothesis. We can summarize this hypothesis as we have progressed it this evening, then, with certain additional points that we had not previously clarified or brought up. First, that there are evidences of the survival of Atlantean peoples, vestiges of peoples who have, for one reason or another, remained completely separate, have held on to their traditions, have regarded themselves as dedicated to a sacred destiny, and therefore regarding themselves also with a strange, deep, unchanging pride, a hauteur about themselves, the sense of being a chosen people, a people intended for some strange work of preserving, without loss, an ancient tradition. This chosen concept certainly moves the Ayas from Northern Asia, for the word Ayan means the chosen, or the selected, or the set-apart ones. Similar records occur in China. The Chinese people were the peculiarly selected ones of the Great Father. Their work was predestined for them. They had to carry on a tradition. We can pause again for a moment and say, how old is China? And China is one of the most disappointing countries in the world to approach archaeologically and ethnologically. We assume beyond doubt the vast antiquity of China, but we cannot prove it. We know that China's records are not nearly as adequate as those of Egypt, nor do they go back as far. But behind these records, again, is a mystery. A mystery of a China that existed in the Golden Age, a China that was remembered faintly in the stories preserved by Confucius and Mencius, and in the annals of the kings, the Shu King of China, the great historical and political writings. So we come to the Greeks, the Chinese, the Hindus, and now comes something else. Out of all of this comes the story of the Golden Age, the story of the ancient time, which was more splendid than any other time that man has ever known. This Golden Age theory corresponds also with the Golden Age of India. For the Hindus have a belief that in the remote past, long before the coming of the Age of Iron, there was a Golden Age. That this Golden Age failed into an Age of Silver. That this in turn fell into an Age of Bronze. And that finally this gave way to an Age of Iron, or an Age of Death. And these four ages are the four horsemen of the apocalypse who ride forth to the corners of the world. And they are the four yugas of Indian philosophy. These ages all stem from a golden age. And this golden age is remembered in Africa and remembered by the primitive Plains Indians of our own country, remembered by the Eskimo. Remembered by the native of the South Pacific. Everywhere there is a memory of the Golden Age. When it was, no one seems to know. But unlike most natural stories of natural beginnings, the beginning of humanity was radiant. And this comes back to us again in the idea of the fall of man. That man fell from a great and noble destiny to some ignominious and relapsed state. The story of the fall, of the destruction of Lucifer, the blasting out of heaven of his planet, Ragnarok. All of these things seem to tell of rebellion, of an ancient time when there was incredible splendor and then it all vanished away. Or as the Greeks more philosophically arranged it, it declined gradually through the other three ages. This Golden Age has been subject to a great deal of study. Psychologists think perhaps that it is the Golden Age of human childhood. That this Golden Age did not actually refer to a time when man had more, but to a time when man thought less. You see, there are several ways you can be happy in this world. One is to have nothing to worry about, and the other is to have nothing to worry with. Both of these have a tendency to relax us. Psychologically speaking, the normal child who has had a happy childhood produces a series of psychological involvements which later cause it to remember back to the age of innocence, to the golden age of play and no responsibility, the golden age of living in a world of fantasy and fairy tales. An age which precedes disillusionment and the sorrows of experience. An age in which there were no fears, but gods in the form of parents take care of everything. Psychologists make a great deal of this particular factor in estimating the character growth of the individual and the possible exaggeration or distortion of this in the creation of the perpetual adolescent. So there's one way of looking at it, that there was this golden age of irresponsibility. But as we study this thing, we find that there is a break in the story that doesn't quite fit. The human child coming into this world of wonders is in a golden age of its own irresponsibility, but it is surrounded by a magnificent and involved culture, a culture which may become desperate in the course of living, but with which the child also has immediate contact from the very beginning. This golden age of childhood is not alone in the wilderness. It is at least surrounded by parents that love and understand. And it is difficult to imagine primitive mankind enjoying this sense of security. It is difficult to imagine that there was ever a time when the primitive savage did not have something to worry about. For with this other problem, we find another rudimentary instinct, which we have been unable to trace to its beginning because it goes back further than anything we can know, and that is fear. Primitive man seems to have existed in fear. He was in the presence continually of forces which were menacing to him. He was a kind of neglected waif, an orphan, And it is not quite as easy to understand how this could have caused him to psychologically invent a golden age. It does not seem reasonable that this golden age could exist apart from association with something superior to self, especially when that self is comparatively primitive. It would be conceivable, however, that the concept of a golden age could exist. Was there an archetype for it? If primitive peoples had lived near or upon the outskirts of a great and glorious civilization, which perhaps, like a paternal colonizing agent, did protect their physical needs, did make it possible for them to pass through a happy childhood, to a degree at least, those particular peoples might have had a golden childhood. Even then, however, there is evidence, as in the case of many children, that this golden childhood is burdened with fears, and that even the best environment cannot prevent the child from ultimately being exposed to that which causes fear. But the whole concept of a golden age does not fit into the theory that man rose from the beast and by the Darwinian concept gradually emerged into humanity through a sort of anthropoid missing link. Something is wrong with the picture. Yet the story of this wonderful place at the beginning of things continues to live, and the peoples claim that there was a time when everything was good, that law and order did prevail, and that as a proof of this, or as part of this, in those days, heroic persons, gods, great and wonderful priests, benevolent patriarchs, enlightened elders, grand and noble teachers walked the earth with men, beings who have never been seen again, who finally retired for one reason or another, always promising to return but never coming back. That all this could have belonged to a great civilizing theme that was wiped away and left in its place only a strange void would seem to be a more reasonable answer. The city of the gods vanished. It did not go back up into heaven. Nobody ever said it did. The only ancient legends that we have about this city of the gods, where anything relating to it is mentioned, this is always associated with two things, or one of them. First of all, that these peoples, living in this peace and glory and happiness, disobeyed. And through this disobedience, they forfeited their share in this golden city and were sent out of the garden like Adam and Eve, cast out into a wilderness, and were forced to clothe themselves with the skins of animals. And that the angels were placed at the gates of Eden with a flaming sword to prevent these sinners from ever getting back in again. That they, from this paradisical world, they were forced out into a world of suffering and pain and death. That is one version of the story. Where the fall version, or the descent of man, or the loss of the divine prerogatives, is not present, then we have the simple account that at an ancient time this world of the gods was destroyed, that it vanished, that it wasn't there anymore. And nearly always this vanishing is attended by combustion and destruction, as in the twilight of the Nordic gods. Either the gods failed and died, or man failed and lost the right to share in the glory of the gods. In any event, man lost his golden age. He was cast out into responsibility. He had to grow up in a strange wilderness. Now, this golden age was not merely an age of peace and comfort, according to the Greek concept, at least. It was an age of achievements. It was an age of great and beautiful cities, of wonderful towns and palaces and monuments, of universities and schools, of hospitals, and of social orders that were so wonderful that they dwelt together in peace and amity, and there was no dishonesty and no stealing, no crime, no sin and no death. And all these things were part of this golden age. So that this was a rich golden age, according to the old legends. But when it finally fell, man came instead into an age of gold, which was not the same thing. And from that time on, his troubles commenced. So we have two stories now. One of a people who disobeyed and who fell. And the other of a people innocent, who did nothing particularly themselves that anyone can be aware of, but whose wonderful protecting world was taken away from them. They were not marked as sinners. In the sagas, the Nordic sagas, the Elder and Junge Edda, humanity didn't do anything particularly wrong. It got into some trouble largely due to the machineries of the gods themselves. But this whole great tragedy of the Nordic myth is not the result of man's wickedness, but the result of the curse of the Nibelungen, the curse of primordial passions and prides played out by the gods upon the broad plains of Asgard. Now, is it quite conceivable that we have here in mythology also the two parts that are necessary for a story, that these two stories do not conflict with each other, but represent the Atlantean deluge as it was applicable to two groups. First, the Atlanteans themselves, and second, to the primitive peoples around them who had come under their influence. That the Atlanteans themselves might well feel that having declared war, as proven by their final attack upon the Athenians, and Plato's record that they had disobeyed the gods who had warned them many times and had finally brought this disaster upon themselves, we can say that the story of a fall, of a disobedience, of a transgression against the great edicts of Poseidon, this could well have been the story of the driving of these people out of their paradisical world, and the placing of cherubs with flaming swords to protect the entrance. Perhaps this entrance, again, has something to do with the Pillars of Hercules at the entrance to the Mediterranean Sea. On the other hand, those people who lived only in the shadow of this splendor, who only knew that in the midst of the world there rose this wonderful city, those who were then the primitive people, might well have gained certain important help from the colonizing and merchandising of the Atlantean mercantile and of the contacts with missionaries or teachers or priests or travelers from this great empire. When this empire went down, these other people were not being punished for a crime. They lost their friend. They lost their teacher. They lost their guide. They lost something which perhaps in their ignorance they had abjectly worshipped because it was so much greater than their own achievement. These lesser peoples lost the directive power which might have more early brought them to a civilized state. They were blessed in that they did not share in the delinquencies which are traditionally said to have destroyed Atlantis. But for them, a golden age vanished. A wonderful divine world sank forever under the sea. The gods they had known never returned. And the great empire of gods, ruled over by Atlas, carrying the earth upon his shoulders, this was gone. And this that had once been a comparatively simple historical circumstance, in the course of thousands of years of tradition, without adequate written records, with the gradual dramatizing and the failing memory of the aged from generation to generation, left only a dream behind. A dream, however, which still has the essential picture, the story of a great and noble race of gods, of heroes, of those who came before men as we know men, and who vanished away, either for their sins or for some unspecified reason. Thus, the Golden Age gives us another clue to our Atlantic story. It also gives us a certain psychological clue. Let us assume for a moment that the Atlantic story is, in a way, the story of humanity. That in this story we have the descent of certain primitive knowledge in man himself. I think it is interesting to go back to some legends. There are some legends in Tibet which have a bearing on this. In Tibet, there was a very wonderful and very great mystical teacher, Milarepa. His hymns and poems and songs are highly revered in this great northern land. Milarepa, however, was born with strange gifts, strange powers. As a small child, he suddenly discovered that within his consciousness there was the ability to affect almost anything he came in contact with. He was a born miracle worker. But as a small child, he didn't know what to do about it. And because he was a small child, and because he was subject to all the natural instincts of children, he began to use this power wrongly. When people heard him, he murmured some strange words that he came to understand in his heart, and these people fell dead. He was able to destroy them with a glance. He was able to curse their crops. He was able to cause their cattle to be barren. And in the old legends about this young man, he really had quite an eventful career, the early part of which was spent mostly in avenging himself upon those he disliked. He found that it was quite simple and easy to use the God powers which he possessed and about which he had no moral understanding. He used them badly. And as a result of that, brought in the Indian legends heavy karma upon his own nature, which later had to be paid. But growing older, he began to be more responsible. And having passed out of the foolishness and selfishness of childhood, he associated himself with learned teachers and good monks and abbots, and in time grew to renounce the world and to dedicate his entire life only to the works of good, thus to pay the debts of his earlier misdeeds and also to become the servant and saint that he was later to become. And this formula, in substance, is behind many saints of Western lands, for many saints were reformed sinners. Now, applied to our Atlantis problem, we seem to see another peculiarity of human nature. Primitive man certainly possessed a psychic contact with life, which we no longer possess. As primitive man, he may have developed his knowledge of this to a prodigious degree and built a civilization strong and tall with pride, the pride of his ability to control nature. And out of his arrogance and selfishness, he set the factors in motion which ultimately undid his own empire, destroyed it, by his selfishness and by the misuse of power. Having thus lost, in some mysterious way, the right to use this power, the very processes which he had set in motion set up their own karma, and this karma blocked these faculties in him so that he no longer had them. In this very moment by itself, a world of inner mysteries, a world of light and color, the worlds of the invisible planes described in Eastern philosophy, man's mysterious contact with the causal universe by means of the mysterious third eye of the Dharma, this would have been blocked out, and he would have seen another world of the gods gradually vanish before him, because he had broken faith with the principles and powers by which he had the right to know this world. So Plato could well have drawn upon this concept also, and this could have its part in the story of the Golden Age. But the Golden Age could also have been one in which man conscious both on the material level and on the internal intuitive apperceptive level, could therefore have built a strange world for himself here, based upon his insight into a spiritual world with which he still had contact. He could have lived in two worlds and fashioned a most glamorous shadow here of the world that he knew there. He could have created, therefore, in his primitive knowledge or his primitive insight, intuitively, instinctively, a great world that was not the product of his own reason, but was the product of the fact that he still possessed the internal contacts with the causal universe around him. Then, as he gradually developed his own intellect, as he gradually strengthened his mind and his resources, and became more and more objectively polarized, the Indian legends tell us that this third eye retired into the brain and ceased to be active. And by degrees, this mysterious world of the gods faded out, and he was left entirely to his own resources. He then had left to him and to the memory of those who came after him only the shadows he had fashioned. The substance was gone. He had forms that were no longer understandable. He had lost the ability to continue to copy living forces. So he built at one time, long ago, something he could never build again. He built it, and gradually, in the course of time, it fell into ruin because his own faculties no longer supported it. And thus your golden age and your ancient worlds and all these things can be part of one tremendous cosmic drama, each a recapitulation or symbolic projection of the other. To go back a moment to Frobenius and his African pattern of things, we have therefore here two levels, a series of levels, in fact. We have the possibility that these Horthy Africans of Ife have this strange subconscious story. Perhaps a story that is more vital to them than it is to us because they are still nearer to the primitive than we are and may have apperceptive powers that we do not know. Primitive people believe they visit the celestial worlds in sleep and from these celestial worlds bring back strange and wonderful accounts. They visit the temples and palaces of their gods in dreams and in visions, indicating that they believe that there is a mysterious world beyond our vision, but not distant in place, and that this world vanished from our consciousness because of our own departure from the primitive ways of natural life. And also, in more recent times, because by degrees we have lost all interest in it and have substituted for the old patterns the gradual development of a material civilization or culture of our own. Frobenius seems to feel that the African peoples form a strong proving link to the various Atlantic hypotheses, and that by studying in those areas, we would come directly into not only the legends, but the ancient rituals and the ceremonies and the mystical rites, which may once have belonged to Atlantis, may have caused its rise or may have brought its fall, but that this entire ancient world is supported upon a strange, shadowy framework of magic, and that it is the divine magic which the gods gave and which the Atlanteans perverted that is supposed to have caused their fall. So that in these areas we get a further development of these stories. And the Africans themselves do believe, many of them, that they came from this glorious world of long ago. And if we are to search for it anywhere in the material sphere, it would seem to tie in to the broad concept of the Atlantic continent. And now we are 1 minute over time, so we're going to have to stop.